The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
Maybe it's just a pipe dream and I'm just a paranoid guy who owns a little too much gold. Here in the United States, I'm glad that I own this. I'm glad that I'm able to move and be and go and do as I please without permission. I like the idea of staking my claim now and not being pushed into a world that is everything on a permission-granted basis.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Well, Dave, would you believe that we're probably going to drop below $2 a gallon at the pump right here about Christmas time? It's the first time we've seen that in years.
You know, I just got back from Europe and I'm thinking, well, that's a fantastic deal. It was at €1.50 per liter in Hamburg. So, yes, it's doubly welcome and very inexpensive. The West Texas Intermediate, which is one of the contracts, Brent is the other, of course, traded below $35 for the first time since 2009.
Natural gas is going down too.
Yeah, we haven't seen those levels since 2002, and I think it's attractive at these levels from an investment standpoint. But here's what's interesting. Oil drops from $115 to $35.
In a couple of years, right?
And should be a huge boost to consumption.
Yeah.
And this decline here in 2015, I think of it as sort of a half and halfer. You had the 1985 to 1986 decline, which was all supply driven.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had the 2008 to 2009 decline, which was demand driven. Prices dropped as global demand for oil dropped. And this, I say, is sort of half and half supply and demand. Many now want to blame Saudi Arabia and OPEC for not lowering their production. And certainly they haven't.
Let me ask you a question, though. I mean, the United States has increased their production. They've almost doubled their production in the last few years.
Right. From 2008 at 5 million barrels per day to 9.3 million barrels per day at present, we have played our part, too, in terms of new supply. The demand side is partially Chinese issue, but more generally, the global malaise that has sort of capped demand. So economic activity globally, fairly weak. And oil's, in my opinion, from an investment standpoint, not as attractive as natural gas, in part because we are seeing structural changes to that space. And really knowing what the implications are at this point may be premature.
Well, and lest we sound like Debbie Downer on all the economic statistics, I mean, we should reach a dividend point where we start seeing economic benefit from low oil or low gas, shouldn't we?
I'm hopeful that sometime in the next 18 to 24 months, we see that energy dividend. Lower prices for a long enough time frame will add consumer purchasing power via increased savings. But in the meantime, we've had very little evidence of that, really little evidence of there being a benefit from lower oil prices. And what we have seen in a dramatic fashion is the fiscal stress that has been building for the producers of oil. Sovereign wealth funds of most of your oil producing nations are now pulling money home from many of their global investments just to pay the bills.
Right.
And that's likely to intensify.
Well, let me bring up again, too, we've had guests in the past who are, you know, specialists in this industry who say the majority of the price of a barrel of oil goes towards taxes. Talking about fiscal stress, I mean, the governments of the world also have to be, you know, stressing not just the energy producers, but the governments that make so much money on, you know, the taxes that come from oil.
And I would be very focused on the demand side at this point, because the supply side, I don't think is going to be the issue, the greater contributor to a price decline or price pressures going forward.
Mm.
We're supposed to have something in the order of 3 million excess barrels per day. U.S. government inventory numbers actually don't show quite as many millions of barrels per day excess. They're coming in closer to 1 versus 3 million barrels per day excess. So I think, quite frankly, with a lot of your new production in the United States not being long-term reliable, you need to focus on the demand side more than the supply side.
Well, and this can be pretty controversial, but, you know, in a couple of weeks, we're going to have Chris Martinson on, and Chris Martinson is, you know, brilliant scientist as far as energy side of things going, and he's thrown warnings out that, you know, it may seem that we have plenty of energy out there, plenty of crude oil energy, but actually it's much tighter than we think. And so his point is, don't let the low prices fool you. You know, we still have energy problems long term.
And I guess my one contention with that is that the peak oil concept, not that he's necessarily a champion of that, but the peak oil concept is really peak cheap oil.
Yeah, it's expensive to get the other stuff.
Exactly, right. Because there is plenty of oil out there. It's just harder to get in awkward places, deep ocean drilling, Arctic drilling, things that from an environmental perspective, you've got lots of hazards against you and costs are much greater to get it done. But back to that energy dividend, you know, it appears that consumers are tending at this point to take any extra that would be a benefit from the lower prices of oil and pay off debts versus increasing their spending. So that energy dividend, yeah, it's helpful, but it's not being put towards anything that equals immediate economic growth.
Well, definitely not in a consumption debt economy. But, you know, speaking of debt driven, you know, we've talked about the triple B and junk bond markets. You know, they've been primed for a crash at some point. We're starting to see that over the last week.
Well, right. And I think this last week was pretty critical. You can mark it on your calendar, not only because it was my birthday. You can remember that, of course. But
yeah, happy birthday, by the way.
Several high-yield funds, they gated themselves. In other words, that's sort of the industry language for closing the ability for investors to withdraw assets.
So that's like Hotel California. You can check in, but you can never leave.
That's exactly right. And so they're in the process of liquidating the entire portfolios, but want to do it in an orderly fashion. And so you had one hedge fund, another mutual fund, actually two different hedge funds last week because one announced at the end of Friday after the markets closed. And so this is the same type of managed money stress, which was occurring in June and August of 2007.
Before the crash.
That's really why you should mark it on the calendar because I really only question whether we see carnage in not only the bond and stock markets. I only question whether it's a 2016 or a 2017 event. We will see it, though.
Dave, I saw a chart the other day. Tell me if I was reading it wrong, but junk bond rates a year ago were 7%, and some of them have jumped already to 17% that were being charted at the same point. Did I miss something?
Yeah, I think so, because, I mean, what we've basically done is gone off of very low levels. We were 5.5% to 6%, and we began to see rates rise this summer. Mm-hmm. Then they contracted again. And now we're seeing them rise again. So let's say your average junk bond is between 7.5 and 9, okay, depending on how far out to the edge it is in terms of risk. It's on the increase off of a very low level. And the difference between that number and treasuries, what they would consider the spread or the gap between them, mm-hmm, that is widening to levels that we haven't seen since the Great Recession, 2007 to 2009.
So it wasn't as critical as what I saw, but as a reminder to the listener, the principal value of the bond is really the most important thing to watch right now because they're dropping as interest rates rise.
And just like a seesaw, that is the natural relationship. As interest rates rise, the value of the paper is dropping on the other side. So prices of that paper are falling at this point. We've described the increase of these credit spreads over the last 3 to 5 months as being very important because they are an indicator of stress in the financial markets. And what you find is that players, as investors, reduce their risk at the edges and they start to limit their exposure to the riskiest of assets. When they begin to have concerns about the big picture, they cut back at what they consider to be the riskiest and most exposed of their exposures. Mm-hmm. And this was occurring this summer in advance of the August stock market sell-off. And that minor trend shifted to a major trend in recent weeks, particularly last week, with those credit spreads widening to levels, again, that you would normally see in the context of a recession.
Well, and credit markets are usually the canary in the coal mine. They're the first thing to start to show a problem, are they not?
Well, they are. And a part of that is because you've got more quantitative investors in the bond market, people who are more fixated on math than story. And equity investors are typically interested in story, and they're willing to sort of check a certain part of their brains at the door. Although you can do some fundamental analysis of a given company, which susses out numbers, and you can do very good sort of forensic accounting, if you will, into a company to see if they're telling the truth and see if they are a good company to short or to buy for the long term. That's not really the approach that most stock investors take, whereas you do have a much more highly analytical approach in terms of credit or bond investing.
So, well, if you think about the guys who are looking at that and buying that, I mean, it's pension funds and insurance companies. I mean, this is the big money that they have to do the math.
Right. So credit markets usually sense problems before equity markets do. Hmm. So quite frankly, it's no surprise that bonds right now in the high yield space, and now it's creeping into corporate bonds as well. They're suffering while stocks are just 6% below all-time highs. So stocks will follow on the downside. But I think this is sort of the step sequence that is pretty ordinary. Credit markets get it first. Equity markets, they're the last to see it. So yes, high yield is the canary. I think you're right about that.
And, you know, interest rates are really just a measure of the potential for a default on that bond. Okay. So, you know, we've talked about some of the European bonds like Spain and Italy, Portugal, countries that are likely at some point to default on their bonds. The interest rates so far have not been showing the potential of default because the European Central Bank has come in and backed them up. But, you know, when you're talking about municipal bonds, when you're talking about junk bonds, triple B bonds, you don't have an ECB to come in and buy them out. You don't have a Federal Reserve even to come in and buy them out. So as far as default goes, are the forecasts for default increasing?
That's the curious thing. At this point, none of the forecasts for default rates have increased significantly. So what it suggests is that most of your Wall Street analysts, not necessarily the investing community as a whole, but most of your Wall Street analysts think that this is a little hiccup, nothing to worry about, no real problems within the bond market at a structural level.
Not a trend, basically.
Not a trend. This is just a minor snafu. And so this is kind of what it looks like. The estimates for 2016 are that there will be about 3% of junk bonds which will default. Now, the long-term average is around 3.6%. So they're assuming that, you know, what we saw last week is not the beginning of a trend. Carl Icahn suggested that there is a lot more to follow on the heels of last week's significant sell-off. And I would tend to agree with that because you look at that 3%, which is expected to default, included in that is a very generous allowance for the very high default rates in the energy sector. So 3% to me seems pretty Pollyanna, a very mild outcome given the context that we're in.
Well, you know, shifting to China, we've been watching China and Russia, but China in particular this last year or two, really wanting to tear itself away from dollar dependency. And, you know, one of the things that China has used for their currency peg, or the thing that China has used for the currency peg, has been the U.S. dollar. Now, we've seen China, the IMF has already said that they're going to be admitted at some point here in the next year into the SDR system, which is like a basket of currencies. Now they're talking about pegging their currency to a basket of currencies. So what effect does this have for the dollar?
Well, it's a long-range thing. The reason we mention it now is because, like oil, which sort of collapsed last week to a surprisingly low level, and high-yield bonds, which were very volatile, these are the things which are now on investors' minds, which could have been on their minds 6 months ago had they been in an anticipatory mode. But no, quite frankly, they're all surprised that these things are happening. Well, China is taking steps that ultimately has a negative impact on the dollar. But again, it's something that doesn't impact us in the next 2 weeks. It's of a generational concern. So the PBOC suggested a new currency peg, shifting away from the dollar towards a trade-weighted index of currencies. And really what it signifies is that the world is moving on. The world is moving on from the assumed U.S. dollar and U.S. foreign policy hegemony. Mm-hmm. And we're losing our footing. I grant you, it's at a very slow pace, but that's why I position it as a generational concern, not something that impacts us in the next 2 weeks. And maybe it's not generational as in so far out on the horizon to be irrelevant. Maybe it's within the next 2 to 3 years we begin to see pressure on the U.S. dollar, significant pressure. Certainly, we'll talk about interest rates and sort of the rest of world ditching of treasuries. We are seeing hundreds of billions of dollars in liquidations in U.S. treasuries. So there's supporting evidence, certainly for, again, sort of that world moving on from the U.S. centricity.
Okay, so you see the ditching of treasuries, but we also see a lot of the yuan coming out of China. There seems to be a flight outside of their very own country.
I think everyone appreciates that there's very little transparency in the Chinese equity markets. You know, it's not uncommon for some companies to have two sets of books. It depends on whether you're presenting it to the tax man or putting yourself up for sale. And, you know, you may show much better one way versus the other. And in China, you may have as many as 5 or 6 sets of books. It kind of depends on what the question is being asked. And so it's interesting. If you can't see the underside of the boat, you should pay very close attention to the fleeing rats. In this case, you've got China net capital outflows for the month of November at $113 billion. October was $37 billion. This is a lot of money and a lot of informed people in China moving out with their money. And again, it's just that issue. If you don't have clarity as to what's going on under the water level, again, the part of the boat that's not too obvious, just watch the behavior of the rats very closely.
Okay. So speaking of below the water level,
this isn't the year of the rat, by the way, I don't think.
Yeah, I don't know my Chinese years, but you know, I resent that we even have to bring this up because everybody's been waiting with, you know, bated breath for every word out of Janet Yellen's mouth. And you know, it makes me think of the song Yellow Submarine, except for we all live in a Yellen submarine, a Yellen submarine, a Yellen submarine. So we have to discuss this Federal Reserve interest rate rise and future rises, even though, like I said, I resent it because the markets should be the ones that actually should be making the decisions, not an academic at the Federal Reserve. So let's talk about the Fed rate increase. What effect is it going to have? And where are we going from here?
Well, you're right. I think part of the ingrained resentment on my part and yours is that we don't like the notion that central planning is at the center of the universe,
right,
instead of individuals aggregating in the market to make decisions and drive prices and trends.
Yeah, but we're trapped. It is like a submarine, Dave. I mean, we really are. We're breathing its air. You know, we've got everything around us and they've shut us off from market reaction in the marketplace. So, you know, is it all talk or are we going to actually see a trending rise from here?
It's the most talked about Fed move in history. If that means anything to you, it means that in most of history, these things are irrelevant, but they've become paramount. And that is problematic. Some have even compared it to 1947 when the idea was that maybe central planners were getting out of the way for the first time in many years in a post-war setting. That really didn't happen until 49. But nevertheless, we have already made history. We've already made history because we haven't raised rates since 2006, which is an all-time record in all of human history, going back 3,000-4,000 years in terms of a zero interest rate policy. So number one, it's significant because you are talking about a long range directional shift, which is significant. Most damaging hikes are still sort of future tense. So it's not what happens this week, which is of great significance. It's when the market becomes convinced that there is a directional shift. And I don't think one move higher of 25 basis points is that clear communication that, yes, we are now in a tightening phase. So repeat after me. We've said this before, three steps and then the stumble. It's typically multiple interest rate increases before the market says, ah, yep, the die is cast. And then there is the readjustment in the marketplace in terms of prices, usually with equities dropping precipitously. So that verdict is still out, whether we have the long range directional shift. But what do we have this week even? We've got support for a move higher. Current inflation stats are now supportive of a hike. And I think the Fed is basically cornered into doing something here in December for credibility's sake.
Well, I'd even been reading articles the last few days that say, even if we, you know, see a couple of hikes, there's concern among some of the Fed presidents that actually we're just going to go right back down to zero, that they're not going to be able to maintain this trend because the economy's not where it needs to be.
Well, it's important that they do something now because they're going to be more hamstrung in 2016. The second point, which makes this meeting so important in terms of the directional shift, that was point one. Point two is that here, heading into 2016, any follow-on moves, if you raise interest rates even more, January, February, March, April, May, June, July, guess what happens in November? In an election year, if you raise rates or lower them, it appears as a political favor to one party or the other, particularly as the year wears on. So the closer we get to that date, it becomes almost like fingerprints. Who's doing political favors for whom and why? And so that plot thickens as we get closer to the date. They must do something in December because they might not be able to do anything as they get into 2016 and remain above reproach.
Well, and instead of looking at the economy as a whole, I mean, these are economists that are running this. Yellen mainly focuses on employment. And we know how vague that number can be. I mean, there's so many different people who can come out with different statistics as to what employment actually is. But that seems to be Yellen's chief focus right now as to whether she measures growth in the economy.
Well, and that also ties into her confidence in the inflation picture improving, because it, too, in her world, is tied to the employment figures.
Isn't that the old Phillips curve at work? I mean, that was discounted. We've talked about it a number of times. That doesn't even work.
That's right. So the good doctor still hasn't realized that the Phillips curve is a joke. People quit laughing at that joke 10, 20 years ago. But when you are a PhD economist in academia, maybe you just don't get out enough. There's actually one Fed chief that does look at the Phillips curve with some suspicion. Lyle Brainard seems to question the functionality of the Phillips curve. Mm. And it's basically this connection. The Phillips curve is connecting an improvement in employment with a rise in inflation on the horizon. And this relationship, which according to the Phillips curve is something that is axiomatic, has broken down in 3 decades of real world practical experience.
Okay, so Dave, let's say you're sitting at the Fed right now and you don't want to look at employment and use the Phillips curve. What points would you be looking at in the economy to make the decision as to whether it's time to raise rates or not?
If you're in those shoes, you're nervous for a number of reasons. You're nervous because this is the latest you've ever gone. Again, in the history of the Fed, this is the latest you've ever gone in terms of increasing rates late in the business cycle. Increasing rates, you know, a third of the way through, 20% of the way through, but certainly before you reach the halfway mark, and we're sort of like 85 to 90% done with this business cycle in a period of time where it would be normal to see a contraction, normal to see a recession, even a mild one.
Which is never a time that you would raise interest rates.
No, you want to be raising into strength, not raising into potential weakness. So why would you be concerned today, tomorrow, this week? These are things to reflect on, and I'm sure the Fed is at this very moment. As we mentioned earlier, credit spreads are widening, and the board is still enthusiastic about raising rates. You've got to wonder if that enthusiasm is, again, sort of a sense of obligation to maintain your credibility, because those credit spreads are telling you something. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist. It just takes someone with a little bit of market experience to say, not all is well here. I think something else that they're looking at, corporate profits are falling. And again, if you're raising rates, you want to do it in the context of an increase in corporate profits. So you should have done this a long time ago. Now it's not very prudent. Companies are already reporting earnings pressures. And as Mohamed Al-Erian recently noted, these corporate players are pleading directly to the central bank for relief. They look at a rising dollar, which is a consequence of this assumed interest rate increase, and it's killing them.
Don't you think we should continue to remember that this economy has been running on life support anyway for the last 7 or 8 years? So to be able to judge economic statistics when you've got quantitative easing, you've got zero interest rates, you've got the Fed coming in and buying anything that looks like it might fail, how are we getting any real results at all that we can measure?
Well, and maybe this hasn't broken into the minds of the Fed chiefs, but is something that surely the markets are now aware of. Most everyone I talk to, even if they don't follow the markets very closely, they're aware that the markets are dependent on central bank support. So take it away, and even an improving economy may be negative for the markets as they try to find their natural level. That is, stocks and bonds getting to that level at which they would trade without the muss and fuss of centrally planned monetary policies. And so that's something that you have to ask yourself the question, what is the natural level if we remove our hands from the pie? What happens exactly? Other things that I think are worth noting, and these are names that may be less significant to you or me, but are very significant in policy planning circles. Barry Eichengreen is an economist at UC Berkeley. He's been on our program before. He's been scratching his head. Why are productivity statistics dead in the water? Productivity statistics have consistently grown since 1996, and now for the third year in a row are dead flat. And so he's sitting there saying, this isn't quite right. We can't quite understand this. And for anyone who reads Eichengreen, which would be everyone at the Fed, you'd say, okay, well, we've got the productivity issue we can't quite figure out. They also look at Larry Summers, who was a part of the President's Economic Advisory Committee, president of Harvard, and of course, famous to us because of his contribution on the Summers-Barsky thesis relating to the relevance of gold in a low to negative interest rate environment. He's been scratching his head here recently at looking at the glaring inconsistency in the economic recovery story where you've got prime-aged males, which, you know, men 25 to 54, are the largest losers of jobs.
Right.
And they're still losing jobs, even as the statistics are suggesting a broad-based improvement in the unemployment picture. And if it was, in fact, a broad-based improvement in the employment statistics, why wouldn't males, these are working-age men, between the ages of 25 and 54, they are the largest segment of job losses still accumulating.
Whereas the person who's over 65 years old, who thought they were going to retire, they're the greatest gain in jobs. They're having to go get jobs again.
So your headline number of 5% may be impressive, and you may base that on the Phillips curve to say inflation will be improving and we'll get out of this sort of economic deflationary malaise very quickly. We're almost there. We must be there. And we just had sort of household rents, you know, added to the CPI, which gave us a boost in inflation. We must be there. I think these are the kinds of things that the Fed is looking and saying, gosh, okay, the details in the jobs numbers, a little bit concerning. Productivity numbers, a little bit concerning. And guess who's drawing their attention on those points? Economists that they respect. Okay, Summers and Eichen Green are respected figures at the Fed. And then, of course, we talked about corporate profits and the other issues as well, credit spreads and what have you.
Right. Well, you know, lest we forget the rest of the world, because sometimes we can be centric on what the Federal Reserve is doing. You and I and a couple of other guys went to Argentina last year, and talking to the people, they were hoping for an administration change. It was ridiculous. Remember, the inflation rate there was 40%. Now what we've had is an administration change. Okay. Cristina's out and we've got Macri in. So what are we going to expect in Argentina?
Don't cry for Cristina. She handed out as many favors on her way out the door as possible. You might cry for Mr. Macri and the Argentina he's being handed, because part of the parting gifts, Kirchner in her final days in office has made an extra $13.7 billion in new government spending commitments. That brings the fiscal deficit that Mr. Macri is inheriting, brings it to 7% of GDP. It's the largest since 1982. So he is inheriting one big fat mess. Now, on the bright side, things have never been this bad, not in 30 odd years. This is a little bit like Turkey in the early 2000s. Mm. Argentina may be at such a low ebb economically that it either just collapses or it becomes the greatest recovery story in the next 10 years. That certainly is what drove Erdogan's popularity in Turkey. Things had collapsed. The Turkish lira was on the brink. The stock market was in tatters.
So there was nowhere to go but up.
Right. So he just steps in and all of a sudden things start to buoy and he gets the credit for it. Well, Macri may be blessed by things being at the brink, as Erdogan was. But I think if he institutes a few pro-market initiatives, the recovery could be impressive. And I guess we'll see. Time will tell. We do need to plan another trip down there, don't we?
That would be a lot of fun. Well, you know, just speaking of other countries, you know, the dollar looks so strong worldwide, yet it's only been rising because the rest of the countries have just been falling apart. And so, you know, this last week, the emerging markets, again, the currencies are just plunging.
Well, the last 2 weeks have been absolutely fascinating. And you know, last week I was in Paris and Brussels and Hamburg. And so a very different perspective. In Paris, of course, you've got the meeting of world leaders to figure out how they're going to tackle climate change and in what degrees of sovereignty are going to be ceded to some sort of international body to solve what is a global crisis worse than terrorism, according to Mr. Obama. The issues in the emerging markets are considerable. And we're not talking climate change here. The way that capital flows is from the developed world to the developing world. And this idea that somehow the developing world was ever going to save the developed world, it's just not the way that capital flows and markets actually operate. So when you see major chaos in the currency, stock, or bond markets of the emerging markets, it tells you something about what's happening in the more developed countries and more developed economies of the world. It suggests that between Europe and the United States, things are punk. At best, things are very, very off kilter and not as they should be. And so I think you're getting very clear signals, mixed signals in terms of the economic statistics and official numbers that come from the various, you know, Labor Department statistics and whatnot here in the United States and globally. If it's official, I think you can discount it. But what you're getting in terms of a clear signal is from places like South Africa and Mexico, etc. So currency volatility continued last week. Many of your emerging market currencies were down 3 to 4% for the week, which is pretty considerable. South Africa was the worst. They were down 10% in 1 week at new all-time lows. But again, the Mexican peso also sets new lows last week. What does this mean exactly? 80% of their foreign trade is with the United States, okay? So if we are in a state of recovery, why are they not in a state of recovery? Why is their currency suffering so greatly? Do you see what I'm getting
at
here?
Well, you know, you sneeze in the United States and it's pneumonia for the emerging markets.
Right, but apparently we don't have anything like a sneeze or a cold or a sniffle, according to the official statistics. And yet, the Mexican peso would tell you that something's not quite right north of the border. That's how it translates to me. And while the ECB, in Europe, the European Central Bank, has been redoubling their efforts, buying everything under the sun via their various quantitative easing schemes, it was absolutely telling, being in Europe this last week, both concerning the European economic conditions, but also global economic strength as well. The German Federal Statistical Office reported last month that the economy slowed in the third quarter due to low corporate investment and very weak exports. And this is with the full tilt efforts of the European Central Bank and the huge benefits conferred from a currency trading at multi-year lows.
So it's like what we talked about here. I mean, they're on life support as well, and it's not working.
Right. So think about that. The engine of economic growth in Europe, Germany, with massive global exports, and they are flailing, even with the help of steroid-like monetary injections. So again, I think the story is very interesting if you can pick up on the signal. Because again, beyond the official statistics, which would quite frankly tell you that all is clear, and yes, the Fed should be raising rates, and it's because they're in a period of strength, et cetera, et cetera. But the rest of the world is indicating that actually, it's not just the rest of the world that has problems, but our closest trade partners too are experiencing problems. Why would our trade partners be having problems if we're in an all clear state?
Well, and it's not always necessarily the economic productivity from the old fashioned sense. A lot of times it's regulation. A lot of times it's just the socialism of the markets. You know, we talk about how the markets will correct things, but if the markets aren't allowed to, you know, think about a market maker. You were talking about your trip to Europe, and I'd like to talk before the end of the program about some of your experiences and what's affecting the free market trade of gold, you know, and silver and to other things to a lesser degree in Europe and what your experience of that was. So first of all, let's define what a market maker is and what role they play in actually bringing about a recovery.
A market maker is willing to carry inventory for a given product and create a two-way flow for that product. You can be a market maker in stocks, in bonds, in gold.
Right.
Theoretically, you could be a market maker in housing, although you don't see anyone sort of sitting on a huge stockpile of homes, buying and waiting for the next buyer to come in and take it off of their hands. So it tends to be quote-unquote liquid assets where you have market makers. But one of the significant things that's happened, both in Europe and in the United States, is the newest regulatory controls, which prevent banks and Wall Street firms, financial entities, from playing the kind of countercyclical role that they have in the past. Now, why do I say countercyclical? Because when the individual investor has an asset that they want to sell, click the mouse and sell it. I mean, that's what we do nowadays. We don't even call brokers to do that. We just sell it.
It's just assumed that there's a market maker out there.
Right. Who buys it? Some company buys it and then connects up that inventory with the next buyer. And they're willing to set on that inventory for seconds, minutes, days, months, or years, depending on the asset in question.
But Dave, you have to have cash. You have to have liquidity to be able to buy inventory in any industry.
Well, that's right. So when you change the capital requirements of a financial institution, it means they don't have as much capital to commit to these kinds of assets. They have to be in, whether it's government securities or cash or what have you, they can't be committed. What does that translate into? When you see a diminished role for market makers, you see less liquidity in any market. And this ties into last week's behavior in the bond market, particularly the high yield bond market. But the bond market in general and corporate bonds were certainly affected to some degree last week as well. With less liquidity, there's much greater downside there's much more volatility in terms of price because, you know, what is the price if the market maker is not willing to buy it? Or if he's bought everything that he wants to, who's going to buy it next? Where does the bid go? And the bid drops until someone else in the marketplace steps in to buy. Bids tend to drop more precipitously when a market maker's hands are tied. And that's exactly what's happened as a consequence of regulatory controls. So last week, other than the oil decline, which we mentioned, the high yield debacle, which was a $3.5 billion liquidation in 1 week, which was a pretty big deal, and the massive emerging market volatility we've already commented on, the two categories that were perhaps even more concerning were bank stocks as a group, which sold off 6%, and broker dealers, which sold off about 7.5% for the week. Why is that worrying? Well, because in an up market, these are the guys that play with a lot of leverage, borrowed assets, borrowed money, and they make a lot of money using that leverage. But in a down market, leverage is doubly damning. And so what it suggests is that people are figuring out, not only in the high yield bond market and in the oil market, but now you're beginning to see cracks in the equity market at the edges. And again, why do I say at the edges? Because your financial institutions are the most highly leveraged. So they truly are at the outer edges of the equity market in terms of risk. Lots of different kind of risk, of course. But I think that's why you're seeing them sell off, is a reappraisal of risk in general. And it's going to spread. It's going to spread to other equity categories as well.
You know, speaking of equity categories, something startling I saw, and this reminded me back of the late 1990s, 1998, 1999, during the tech stock boom, right before the tech stock bust. The S&P 500, which has been doing relatively well, there were only 10 stocks that made up the majority of the move. I mean, 10 stocks on the S&P 500 had better than a 21% gain. That's very respectable. But the rest of them, if you took it as a whole, were down over 4%. So when you're looking at a market index, it is good to see just, you know, how divided that index is.
Well, that's right. Fred Hickey points to the parallels between now and the early 1970s, where fewer and fewer names were driving those indexes. What he recalls as a crowding into the Nifty 50 then, not unlike the crowding we see into five NASDAQ stocks today, which are both overvalued and overowned, in Fred's opinion.
So, just like in the late 1990s as well.
Yeah. So for those looking at the broad cross-section of equities, look, your utilities sector is down double-digit for the year, as are the Dow Transportation Average, down better than 10, almost 12% for the year. The S&P and the Dow Industrials are getting by with help from a few names, but breadth, that is, if you're looking at how the broader index is behaving compared to the headline number, it's awful. Goldman's breadth measurements are at a 30-year low. So just to return to that sort of over-owned issue, in a downturn, what that translates into is far higher volume of liquidations as well.
So what you're saying is you have a few super achievers, and then you really, the rest.
And everyone piles into them.
Yeah.
But everyone piles in on the basis of past performance, and then about the time the market turns, everyone who piled in is piling out, which means your losses can be more concentrated in those names as well. So you've got Amazon selling at a price earnings multiple of 973, or if you're looking at next year's estimated earnings, the hope for number, what we hope happens next year, then they're only trading at 359 years worth of earnings.
So in other words, the break even, it would be 359 years instead of 973 years. Well, I hope those earnings come in. I know I've been buying a few things from Amazon, so I'll try to help.
Well, that's right. Well, Netflix is at a price earnings ratio of 333, and they're expecting their earnings to be down next year, 2016, so their PE forward-looking is 481. These are the mirror images to the technology wonders of the 1970s, Kodak, IBM, Xerox. You probably recall Fred Hickey was on the Barron's Roundtable along with our commentary guests, Felix Zulauf and Mark Faber, and he's suggesting that we are watching the last gasps of a dying bull market and economy. And he's suggesting it again because when you get to the end of a market, everything's failing on a broad base. And everyone begins to go after the only things that seem to work. So there's a clustering or a crowding effect into the few things that are work, the few names that have gone up. So you have a few things that are up 50, 100, 150%, and everyone is piling in. He's suggesting that that's exactly what you get at the end of any bull market. So he's also suggesting that the leaders as they roll over. And in this case, you're talking about four or five tech names which are driving the NASDAQ and holding up the S&P 500. When that happens, when they fall to pieces and crash, he reminds us that gold stocks are likely to soar, just as they did in the 1970s. And he includes a quote from an esteemed economist, German economist, who published a bunch of textbooks with Stanley Fisher, one of the guys who's currently at the Fed, Rüdiger Dornbusch, who says, in economics, things take longer to happen than you think they will. And then they happen faster than you thought they could.
Mm.
And I think, given that we are on the edge of things here at the end of 2015, with 2016, maybe it's 2017, but this time frame, it's giving us ringside views to an economic death match.
Well, and for those listeners that are still listening, that didn't turn you off the second that you said maybe gold stocks would go up. Now, that wasn't your quote. That was someone else's quote. But for those who are still listening, okay, they have been asking us, when will this happen? It seems like it's been taking forever because the Fed has just been extending this and extending this. But this quote basically says exactly what we've seen before. It seems like it takes forever for reality to catch up. But when reality does catch up, man, all you're seeing is the airbag blowing up in front of you as you get into the crash. I mean, that's your only view. It happens quick.
I had one of my best friends send me an email last night, and he just said, I think I own too much gold. I've got to diversify. A friend of mine is recommending a biotech company. Should I buy it? And I thought, you know, as painful as it has been to own gold and gold shares over the last several years, when they move off of lows, it's generally a 10 to 20 fold move. That's what it has been off of these kinds of levels. Multiple times, I mean, three or four times in the last 30 to 40 years. And I think we're setting up for that kind of performance again. Can I guarantee that? Well, I wish I could, but I think it's highly probable. Given the fact that we're running out of monetary ammunition and we're moving and transitioning towards the fiscal stage of desperation, where governments around the world try to get creative, both by squeezing people via the tax code and any other method they can. You know, speaking of governments and what they're doing or not doing, the Z1 flow of funds report came out last week, and it was very interesting. The largest asset on the federal government's balance sheet, can you take a guess what it is? Student loans, of course. The largest asset of the United States government are student loans, $931 billion. Of course, the total number, including privately owned debt, that is student debt that's not owned by the government, other private programs, brings it to $1.2, $1.3 trillion total. But $931 billion, you realize that the total stock of gold, if you're taking 1050 as a gold price, the total stock of gold, 8,600 tons, is worth less than $240 billion. So the student loans that the government has on its balance sheet
is about four times.
Is almost four times the value of all the United States gold. And that's the largest single hoard of gold in the world today. Do you kind of see how things are a little bit out of kilter? Well, the Z1 flow of funds report, this was compliments of Doug Noland, done for the third quarter, credit contraction in every segment. And like we said when we were talking with Mark Faber, we're probably 6 months into a recession.
Right. He said it was an industrial production recession, but that transfers on.
Well, in credit growth, it is slowed in every category. It's slowed in terms of household debt. It's slowed in terms of government debt. It's slowed in terms of corporate debt. Credit growth slowed in every category. It was cut in half, in fact, when we're talking about corporate credit growth. It was growing at an 8.8% rate. Now it's 4.3%.
Well, and to any rational person who is managing their own budget, they would say, well, gosh, that's great. Credit growth is not growing. That's the way it should be. We should be spending what we have. But we live on a consumption-based, you know, you had talked about Richard Duncan. And Richard Duncan has pointed out that we don't grow anymore based on productivity. We grow based on debt. And so when credit growth actually shrinks, we're shrinking.
Yeah, we don't have a demographic dividend. We don't have a productivity dividend. We don't have a technological dividend. There would be increasing productivity. We are debt addicted, and that's Duncan's point. He thinks like an Austrian and then sort of maneuvers and transitions to sort of what we have, which is a Keynesian world. And he says, well, here's what we're left with.
Right.
All this is relevant because our economy is debt addicted. And at present, we cannot grow without an increase in debt. And that's Duncan's point.
Which is hard to do because people are selling treasuries, not buying treasuries right now.
Right. His point is that if we're not growing sufficiently in these categories, government debt, household debt, corporate debt, if we're not seeing those things increase net of inflation by better than 2%, which according to these Q3 numbers, we are not, guess what you have? Axiomatically, you have a recession. You are in a recession. Like it or not, our economy is debt addicted and it needs an ever increasing dose of credit, or you have an economic fit. And that's what we're on the cusp of.
But foreigners sold almost $500 billion worth of treasuries here recently.
Well, that's also in the Z1. The rest of world holdings of all U.S. financial assets declined by $299 billion. And the largest category of decline was U.S. treasuries, where foreigners sold $492 billion.
And that's how we borrow. That's how we borrow. So if we can't sell the treasuries, we have to buy them ourselves.
Right, which means we'll be mandating that banks and insurance companies and pension funds and others take up the slack. And of course, the federal government can step in and through QE programs, buy up any excess as well. It's interesting. We're moving into this strange phase where we could have a scarcity of treasuries, but it's a scarcity driven by government artificial buying and the mandated buying that's handed down by regulatory requirement.
Well, and speaking of regulatory requirement, you talked to the group here at the office here just about an hour ago about your trip. You and Drew went to Europe and your son, and things are changing over there, but I think you should share that with the listeners because it needs to be something that's prepared for on this side of the Atlantic as well.
I think what's disturbing is the role of the state there and the presumption of the state continues to grow and grow and grow and grow. We spent time in Brussels, in Paris, and in Hamburg. Of course, I mean, we're in the precious metals business, so it's common for us to be in circles of diamond dealers and gold traders and art dealers and things of this nature. And what's fascinating is there's only two places in the world that don't have a statute of limitations. If you believe that someone is doing something nefarious and you want to investigate them, you can begin the process in these two countries and never formally issue charges or level an accusation, and there is no recourse once the sort of the damage has been done initially. So, you know, these two countries are North Korea and Belgium.
Two very different countries in our perception, but actually regulatorily very similar.
They are very similar. The only difference is that Belgium doesn't have the cult following of a particular leader. It's more done by a diffuse group of technocrats. But the reality is, the rules that emanate from that place are so ominous. Well, granted, I mean, they don't run slave labor camps and things like that. The North Koreans do. In all fairness, there is a vast difference between North Korea and Belgium. But it's interesting that these two places, if you get on the wrong side of the law, even if you've done nothing wrong, for instance, a diamond dealer who 9.5 years ago had millions of dollars worth of his inventory confiscated, do you know that he's never been charged with anything? He's never been charged with anything.
He just was under suspicion for something.
Under suspicion for whatever, and he has no legal recourse. This is the heart of the European Union,
right,
where you would expect some reference to the rule of law, and he has no legal recourse, and there is zero statute of limitations. This is very, very interesting, in my opinion. We spent some time in Paris. The gold business in Paris has changed dramatically. There is very little product coming to market because the government wants traces and tracks on everything. They want a record of where every last coin was purchased, every last bar was purchased. And this is not just a tax consideration, because what the French people resist is sharing information with governmental authorities because their own government has confiscated gold from them seven different times.
Seven times. We've confiscated once here in America.
And we have American investors who are concerned about a repeat of an FDR 1933 event. I don't want to disparage that notion. Maybe it happens, maybe it doesn't. But if you're French, you have far more reason to be concerned.
Right.
This is a pattern. This is a pattern. And so what we're seeing is, with an increased expectation of paperwork on every liquidation of every asset, people are saying to themselves, I'm just going to hold on to what I've got. It just doesn't matter. And so product flow from Europe to the United States is slowly being squeezed off. in large part because of the regulatory apparatus, in large part because of the role and the footprint of the state in the private markets.
You know, we talked to Drew several times over the last couple of years about this hoard of coins that he was able to get into, and we really felt very blessed. I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of exactly what we needed, but we're coming to the end of that. I think this last trip, you were told by our contacts over there,
there's no encore.
There's no encore. This is it. Yet, you know, you look at these types of things that come down, and black markets form, Dave, just like we saw in Argentina. Black markets form as the regulations increase. And, you know, I'm thinking about, okay, you had given an example I'd like you to give about if you were French and you found something on your property, okay, versus being English over in Britain and finding something on your property. I think there's a comparison contrast if you tell that story so that people can understand just how these markets will adapt to regulation, and actually a black market in a way sort of forms.
So roll the clock back to medieval times and just sketch out a timeline from then, say, to the 1940s or 1950s. War-torn Europe, you've been through World War I and World War II, and if you have assets that, quite frankly, gold and silver that you may have, it's not something that you're going to put in a lockbox at your local bank. In the medieval time, you didn't have that option, and in wartime, you weren't sure if the bank was going to be around. It might be bombed to oblivion or taken over by the enemy.
In other words, get out the shovel.
Get out the shovel.
Yeah.
So there's all kinds of gold buried throughout Europe and throughout England. And in fact, in the last year, 105,000 instances in England of people digging up treasure of one sort or another. Some of this can be just sort of, you know, an old pottery shard that needs to be recorded with the local authorities. And in England, what happens is a unique process. You record it, you document it, you catalog it, and then that catalog is made available to every museum in England, and they have the opportunity to bid for it and pay fair market price for it. You dig it up on your land, it's yours if you're in England.
Which seems reasonable.
You dig it up on your land in France, you have to document it, catalog it, hand that catalog over to the local authorities, and then they arrange to pick it up because it's theirs. What you find on your property is not yours because the presumption is it's ours to begin with.
Is it any wonder that the Magna Carta came from England, not France?
Not France. Well, so 105,000 instances of those kinds of filing last year in England, 3 in France. And I'd be curious to know what kind of people those 3 people were. But this is the market adjusting to a state imposing expectations that are unreasonable.
Yeah, so the moral to the story is the black market formed in France. There are people who are digging up, just like they are in England, they're digging up gold or what have you, but no one's getting a chance to hear about it. So maybe that's why the Louvre is probably filled with just about what it's going to have, whereas actually the British museums are amazing.
You know? Well, and so I look and I think the direction we're heading here in the United States, we have a different reference point in terms of freedom, liberty, the rule of law, certainly in contrast to France. And it's an extension of what we gained from British common law, the Magna Carta, development of Black's Law, and other big keystones in sort of our judicial progress and legal progress, evolution, if you will. And it's remarkable. We're giving up ground. That's true. We are giving up some ground here in the United States. The Constitution is being looked at in a different way. It needs to be revised, modernized for modern times. And the problem is that the modernizers are, many of them, technocrats. Mm-hmm. Many of them are statists. Many of them are central planners. And whatever revisions occur, I'm afraid, take us much closer to the sort of things that we see in Brussels today.
Sort of like the changes that we saw in Orwell's Animal Farm. You know, all animals are created equal, but there are animals that are a little more equal than others.
Well, and I conclude, coming away from this sort of disgusting taste in my mouth experience in Europe. I mean, I love Europe. I love the culture. I love lots of things about it. The people are wonderful. But the political dynamics turn my stomach. And I think to myself, the role of gold in these communities has and always will be establishing someone's financial footprint and individual autonomy, regardless of what the state is willing to grant you. Mm-hmm. It is your staking your claim, regardless of what the powers that be believe your claim is.
Do you think those people who have that autonomy really care about the gold price on a daily basis?
And no, they don't. No, they don't. Yeah. And I reflect and think, maybe it's 2 years from now, maybe it's 20 years from now. Maybe it's just a pipe dream and I'm just a paranoid guy who owns a little too much gold. But at some point in the future, it seems reasonable that those same sentiments are real-time experiences. People say, here in the United States, I'm glad that I own this. I'm glad that I'm able to move and be and go and do as I please without permission, on a permission-granted basis. I like the idea of staking my claim now and not being pushed into a world that is everything on a permission-granted basis.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.